Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. I am Sandy Ingham. I am Prairie's part-time minister. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation, which means we welcome you. No matter what your ethnic or religious background is, your color, your sexual orientation, gender, family structure, physical abilities, inabilities, color of hair, color of eyes, and so on. But anyway, we do aspire to be open and welcoming, and I think we generally manage that. I do encourage you, if this is one of your first times here, to come back, because the services are different on Sunday morning. Sometimes I obviously do the service. Sometimes people, lay leaders from within our congregation, do the service. And sometimes we have people from outside our congregation do the service. The opening words then are by Unitarian Universalist Minister David Miller. No, I'm sorry, they're by Unitarian Universalist Minister Max Kootz. Getting ahead of myself. We need a celebration that speaks the spring-inspired word about life and death, about us as we live and die through all the cycling seasons, days, and years. We need the sense of deity to crack our own hard, brown December husks and push life out of inner tombs and outer pain. Unless we move the seasons of the self and spring can come for us, the winter will go on, and Easter will remain a myth, and life will never come again, despite the fact of spring. Mary, would you light the chalice, please? We light this chalice as a symbol of our thankfulness. The chalice reminds us of the sun, the giver of life, which we occasionally see. The flame rises up like the power of growth and renewal in the springtime. We give thanks for the sun, which lights and warms the earth, for the growth and renewal of nature arising from the earth, and for the earth itself. The reading I would like to share with you now is by Unitarian Universalist Minister Kathleen McTeag. She titles it Easter Resurrection. And this is, she begins her little reading here with one version of the Easter story and her take on it. The Easter story, as told in the Gospel of John, revolves around the experience of one person, Mary Magdalene. It's Mary who gets up before dawn on the day after the Jewish Sabbath and goes alone to visit the tomb. Her beloved teacher has died a horrible death, and it was only by the unexpected generosity of a wealthy man that Jesus was given even the small, late dignity of a real burial place instead of a pauper's grave. Because of the Sabbath, his body had not been cleaned according to tradition, and Mary set out early with her herbs in order to do this last grieving service. But when she got to the tomb, she found that the stone blocking its entrance had already been rolled away and his body was gone. It isn't hard to imagine her despair and anger at being robbed of even this last farewell. She ran to some of Jesus' other followers with the news, and they came back with her to see for themselves. They probably stood there for a while arguing about what to do, but there was nothing to be done. Who would you complain to when you risked your life, even admitting to the authorities that you had known him? Filled with that bitter realization, they finally left again. But Mary stayed alone and weeping. maybe something defiant, crept in with her grief that made her brave enough to stay. Then she caught a movement, and out of the corner of her eye, and she turned to find someone standing there. "Why are you crying?" he asked. "Who are you looking for?" Thinking he must be the gardener, she said, as carefully as she could, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you've put him, and I'll take care of it. I won't tell anyone. I'll just take his body and clean him up so he can rest in peace." Then Jesus, because of course it was Jesus standing there, and she didn't recognize him, Jesus just called out her name, "Mary." And then she knew. And she said back to him, "Rabbi." For those of us who believe that Jesus was a human being like us, the idea of his literal resurrection from death is a leap of faith we can't quite make. We know that when our bodies die, they die. We belong to the earth. And it is comforting and right to know that we dissolve again into that sweetness. But we can believe in Mary's resurrection. When Mary heard her name called, suddenly her eyes were opened to a new reality. She was called out from the blindness of her grief and despair, and from within herself, she found a new way to see and to understand what had happened to her. McTigg says, "I take that Easter story as truth. It points to the moments in every life when something within us is called out, called forth, called to a deeper understanding of our world. Easter raises the question. In this bright opening of the earth, in this turning season when new life is pouring out all around us, what will we bring forth from within ourselves? It's a time that calls us to open our eyes in a new way, to see not just what we expect to see, but perhaps some bright and mysterious truth we could not fathom before, something completely new and unexpected. We are a troubled tribe, we human beings. The unfolding story of our time on earth is clouded with pain and cruelty, with missed opportunities, unthinkable heedlessness and indifference. It is also marked by the bright notes of decency, kindness, freedom, and courage. Easter proclaims that we each have a part to play in how the story unfolds, if we are willing to wake up. We listen for what is calling to us. And like Mary, when we hear our name, we answer, rising anew to meet the life that will not stop calling our names. Last weekend, I took part in a workshop at James Reeb Unitarian Universalist Congregation, along with a few other people from this congregation. I took part in this workshop where we talked, among other things, about culture, our personal culture, the culture of the country in which we live, the culture of our congregations, and the lenses through which we each view the world, our ingrained perceptions of how the world is. We were shown a cartoon. We were shown a lot of cartoons that help keep us awake. We were shown a cartoon of a rhinoceros standing at an easel painting a beautiful real-life landscape with other paintings that he or she, the rhinoceros, had done, scattered around, propped up on the ground. Every single painting, the rhinoceros was a good painter, had this, you know, beautiful rendering of whatever the landscape he or she had chosen to paint. But in the middle of each frame, of each painting, was the rhinoceros horn. Because that's
what the rhinoceros sees, landscape. And then we did a lot of talking about our personal rhinoceros horns, because we all have them. We ended on Saturday afternoon by considering how we could share with our congregations what we had learned and discussed. And when we were discussing the different cultures of the three, of the three Unitarian Universalist congregations in Madison, someone quipped, actually someone from James Reeb, someone I know quite well, that First Unitarian is known, I don't really remember what she said, I think being the big church probably, James Reeb is known for being very, very welcoming. And Prairie, well, Prairie, she knows what I do for a living. And she was sitting beside me. Prairie is known for being opposed to anything spiritual. Everyone laughed, including me. I did stutter out a sentence like, "We're trying." But I don't think this was an accurate description of Prairie at all. In fact, I'm surprised that we still have this reputation. You had that reputation 40 years ago when I first started going to First Unitarian.
It was wrong then,
too. I'm getting to that, Rick. Well, but so you can see why it surprised me. Well, it might not be a word everyone here is comfortable with. I believe that we are all spiritual. That spirituality is a common universal component of being human. Whether we are atheists, humanists, Buddhists, Christians, Muslims, pagans, agnostics, Hindus, and on and on. One of the roots, which many of you probably know, of the word spiritual is breath, wind. To be spiritual is to be life-affirming, interested not so much in the material world, but more in what is sacred, mysterious, awesome in the best sense of that word, amazing in this world. Have you ever suffered loss, ever grieved, ever been in despair, doubt, depression? Then you are a spiritual being. Ever felt joy, delight, amazement? Any or all of these makes you a spiritual creature. Life is not about you or me, even though we act that way. It is about something much bigger. Call it love, call it God, call it nature, call it the ground of being, call it the common good. Are you opposed to tribalism? Are you opposed to prejudices and stereotypes, to religious boundaries? Then you are spiritual. Unitarian Universalist minister Lisa Presley, the leader of the workshop, said something that I have believed for some time. By ignoring or even vehemently opposing anything from the Christian tradition, we lose a certain richness that could serve us well. We too often deny an important part of our heritage by ignoring our Christian roots. So glad he's playing Jesus today, Christina. We'll talk later. Presley was talking about the richness of other faith traditions besides Protestant Christianity, but Unitarian Universalists tend to be more respectful of other faith traditions, such as Buddhism or the beliefs of Native Americans, than we are of Christianity. This discussion and my thoughts about Holy Week still going through my head last Sunday morning. I didn't have any duties here last Sunday morning, so I was in my hiking pants, hiking boots, you know, and I was making my way on foot to Prairie. My walking route takes me past Queen of Peace Catholic Church and what we called as Presbyterians the manse, I think Catholics call it that, where the priests live. It's right next, that's it, I knew manse didn't sound right.
Refectory.
Rectory.
Rectory.
Yes. It's right by the parking lot of Queen of Peace, the one on Owen. Okay. So I walked by, and it wasn't my usual time. It was about 7:45 in the morning. And wouldn't you know, a priest was just leaving the rectory. "Hello," I say. "Happy spring." There I was, as I said, in my hiking pants and shoes without my clerical collar.
don't really have one. And the best I could do on this Palm Sunday was happy spring. It seems so lame. He was pleasant, said hello, and proceeded on to the church, I suppose for the 8 o'clock mass. Wait, I wanted to say. Wait, stop a minute. I want to ask you about the richness of your tradition. Maybe I even want a moment of confession. We're sorely lacking in this area in my tradition. But I've done stupid things. I've hurt others. I have hurt myself. I have made wrong decisions. I've forgotten that I am part of the earth and I've mistreated the earth. I need redemption. I need to confess and know that I am still loved. Can you help me out? Well, I didn't do that. I did manage to make myself laugh and appreciate this moment of, I suppose, what could be construed as silliness. And yet, we are lacking in some areas. We're missing an opportunity to be more fully human, I think, when we don't acknowledge Easter and its importance to the essence of Christianity, the faith tradition out of which both our traditions, Unitarianism and Universalism, developed. I believe that we're missing something by ignoring Easter totally or by celebrating it only as the beginning of spring. Many Unitarian Universalists can't get past the idea of resurrection, even if we mean it metaphorically, and I suspect everyone in this room would mean it metaphorically, but it's okay if you don't. Why do we let fundamentalists and evangelicals co-opt language? Why do we fear certain words? Words like sin, forgiveness, redemption, atonement, resurrection are pretty powerful words. Max Gabler, a name some of you may know, who's now still alive in his mid-90s, minister emeritus at First Unitarian Society, an amazing man, just so brilliant. And my UU minister, my first UU minister, my mentor in many ways. He told a story, he liked to tell this story around Easter time, and he claimed it was his personal story, but I don't know. He was in downtown Chicago and many years ago, and a man with, you know, the signboard on, the end is near, the end is coming, and it was Easter time of the year, and the man was carrying a sign that said, repent, repent, and he was walking along, and he was, guilty, 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 he was saying to different people, and he looked right at Max, and he said, guilty. And I don't know what Max may have done or not done, but Max thought, how did he know? We all sin. That's a word that we have to reclaim, I think. I don't like the dictionary definitions. They're okay. An action that is or is felt to be highly reprehensible. A vitiated, who uses that word? State of human nature in which the self is estranged from God. But the best definition of sin I've ever heard is not in the dictionary, probably should be, being out of right relationship, being out of harmony, being not in harmony with yourself, with others, with the earth. We all need forgiveness, we all need to be redeemed, and I think we all yearn for atonement and resurrection. Atonement is a hard word to define, I think, but it's simple if you just take it apart, at one ment. Harmony and balance again. So I think we can work on expanding our vocabulary, and I think that Easter and Good Friday every year give us this opportunity to go through the process of recognizing our sins and acknowledging that we are out of right relationship, that we need forgiveness, that I need someone. Don't worry, I'm not going to set up a confessional. Oh, there's that space over there now, though. to say, you are forgiven. You are forgiven by the love of the world. You can come home. We need that. And I know that these are strong words from a humanist minister. But I don't believe that my humanism is diminished one bit by using these words, by being aware that I need redemption.
Interestingly, the word under the definitions of atonement in the dictionary, the one word that I could really glom onto to define it is considered obsolete, and that word is reconciliation. Perfect. I think the definition should be resurrected. Many Unitarian Universalists misunderstand Christianity and the importance of Jesus. And now I think we could place the blame on the Christians somewhat for misrepresenting Jesus for hundreds and thousands of years. But we're all grown-ups. We can go to the web. We can read about Jesus. Some of you may know this name, John Shelby Spong. Read him. He's a retired Episcopal priest and bishop. He's quite controversial, especially among the Episcopals, because he wants to redefine Christianity. And I think one of his best books, and I've drawn on it for this morning, is Jesus for the Non-Religious. Now, Spong has spoken at our General Assembly and at many Unitarian Universalist congregations throughout this country, and we all tease him about being a closet UU, which he hasn't denied. Before I give you a little bit of Spong's interpretation of the real Jesus, I'll remind you that Jesus was killed, murdered by the state and the church for the way he lived his life. That is, for defying both state and church by associating with people from all walks of life, by practicing radical hospitality, what we now call open table fellowship, by breaking down traditional boundaries, by preaching peace. Think about that. Think about how awful a death that was. And think about the fact that we still kill people for these reasons. To move to a place in our collective Unitarian Universalist thinking where we can cherish the wisdom and life of Jesus requires a better understanding of that person. Here we are in the 21st century, and many of us still don't get it when it comes to Jesus. Reverend Spong carefully unpacks the Easter story. He'll give you literally chapter and verse, but it's okay, you can skip those parts in the Jesus for the Non-Religious. He points out those places, many discrepancies in the New Testament about what happened after the crucifixion. Spong finds no evidence, and Spong and many, many others, of a literal rising from the dead. But that was never the point. The point of the Easter and the Good Friday stories is that something remarkable happened to the people who were there. Something, and this is historically documented, something amazing transformed them, particularly the disciples. But the disciples consisted of more than the 12 we always hear about. There were men and women. Something transformed them from cowards. Remember, they betrayed Jesus. They were cowards. But something changed, and they became brave souls who went out into the world to preach the gospel, not, despite what you may think, to convert people, and not to shove a new religion down their throats, but to repeat and repeat and repeat what Jesus said. There's nothing about shoving anything down anybody's throat in what Jesus says. And to tell and retell the stories of how he lived his life. Easter was and still is a time of transforming experience, a time of mystical experience, as is the turning of winter into spring. There are some things that cannot be expressed in words. This is where liturgy comes into being. We're not going to get into liturgy today other than that. But whatever it was that so astounded the people at that first Easter, they couldn't express it in words, which is one of the main reasons we get so many versions of what happened in the Gospels and Paul's letters, because it didn't stop people from trying to explain it in words. I mean, that's how we explain things generally. For the last couple of thousand years, theologians and biblical scholars and many, many thoughtful people have tried to put the Jesus story into words. And those words often include the words that we sometimes have trouble with,
the words I keep referring to this morning. Don't literalize Easter, to use Spong's phrase. We do a great disservice to ourselves and to humanity in general when we do this. It's not important that Jesus didn't live on in the flesh. I realize I couldn't say that from the pulpit in a great many places in this world. It's not important that he didn't live on in the flesh. The importance is that what he preached and practiced does live on. And we're still struggling to be as fully human as he was. Spong calls Jesus the most fully human being who ever lived. I think I agree with that. We are still fighting to move the human race beyond tribalism, beyond prejudice, beyond religious boundaries. And this is scary territory. Look around. Read the news. Be aware. How intense is the pushback? The pushback to keep us from moving beyond those things. It's everywhere. Consider the following. Breaking tribal boundaries. Think about the culture of the time in which Jesus lived. The Jewish culture. There were the chosen people. That would be the Jews. And there was everyone else. That would be the Gentiles. The unchosen ones. Jews did not have dinner with Gentiles. But Jesus did. Jews were not supposed to even interact with Gentiles, but Jesus did. Spong asks this question, which I believe is still relevant. How can one be fully human if one was busy rejecting all those who are not Jews? And you can substitute, as applicable, the word Jews for any number of other words. Jesus was the ultimate practitioner of open table fellowship. That is, everyone was welcome to be at that dinner table with Jesus. I know that many of you were raised Christians, so many of you will recall some of this. Prostitutes, tax collectors, everyone was welcome. Gentiles, Samaritans, oh my goodness. Remember Levi? Do some of you remember Levi, the Jewish tax collector who worked for the Gentiles, which automatically made poor Levi unclean? Jesus invited him to be one of his disciples. Consider breaking prejudices and stereotypes. Many of you are probably familiar with the parable of the Good Samaritan, that only person out of three people who stopped to help someone in need. The other two, a priest and a Levite, were big deals, higher ups in the hierarchy of Judaism there in the first century. Those two saw only an unclean person that they, according to the rules of their religion, were not to touch. So they couldn't stop and help him. The Samaritan responded only out of compassion. He saw only a human being in need of help. You have to try to understand the context in which Jesus told this parable. As Spong puts it, Samaritans were the unclean, rejectable scum of the first century Jewish world. And yet here was Jesus making that Samaritan the hero of the story. And finally, consider religious boundaries and the breaking of them. The Jewish religion into which Jesus was born supposedly taught him that moral rules are ultimate. In other words, that Jewish religion, his upbringing, should have given Jesus a pretty good dose of righteousness and taught him all about being judgmental. Well, it didn't take. These teachings were lost on Jesus. Some of you might recall the gospel story of the woman who committed adultery and was taken to face the scribes and the Pharisees, the mucky mucks. These religious leaders knew what to do with her. Find her guilty, sentence her to death, probably by stoning. A lot of stones around is cheap, and you just roll them over in the ground, you know. And we know this still goes on. In an attempt to trip Jesus up, one of many such attempts, the authorities asked Jesus to sentence her, to do the sentencing, to say how she would be killed. Well, Jesus said to them, well, gives you all the right to judge her. How come? How come you get, how qualified are you? And that biblical story ends with a phrase many of you know, let him who is without sin cast the first stone. Jesus broke religious boundaries many times. As Spong tells us, Jesus was always trying to call people into a new, fuller humanity. Anything that puts limits on humanity, anything that teaches one to hate or to reject or to violate another, cannot be of God, of love, or stating it slightly different, cannot be sacred, life-affirming, spiritual. Was it any wonder that the religious leaders of Jesus' time were afraid of him? He threatened their power. Jesus challenged people to live their lives beyond rules, defenses, tribal boundaries, prejudices, and even religion, to embrace abundant life. What we would maybe call now, step out of those comfort zones, big time, so that you might become more fully human. This challenge is still relevant, still out there waiting for us to accept it. But first, we have to be humble enough to admit that we sin, that we need forgiveness, that we yearn for redemption and atonement. We have to be resurrected. Then we can accept that challenge. Here is one of my favorite resurrection stories. I've told it before, but it was some time ago, so I'm counting on you not remembering. And some of you will not have heard it anyway. It is a story of Rebecca Parker's, another mentor of mine, a Unitarian Universalist minister and a Methodist minister, and president of Starking School for the Ministry when I was there. And she has been called one of the outstanding theologians of the 20th and now the 21st century. Rebecca begins this story of hers, a true story, pondering the deepest question that she believes, and I believe too, all religions must address: am I willing to live? She goes on, I asked that question once. It had been a year of grief. In a situation of broken love, I chose to have an abortion. I felt it was the only thing I could do, but I was haunted by the loss of that surrendered child. My grief deepened as days passed. Time was not healing my sorrow, and I spiraled into deeper and deeper despair. By day, I would dutifully, and to all appearances cheerfully, perform my responsibilities as the minister of a small and vibrant congregation. At night, I couldn't sleep. I'd rise, pace the empty halls of the parsonage, and wail. My despair and isolation came to a crisis one night. I was past living one day at a time, or even one hour at a time, and I was down to the question of whether I would be willing to continue to live at all. In the depths of that sadness, I left my house. It was after midnight. I walked down the hill to Lake Union. She lived in Seattle at this time. The city was quiet. My face was wet with tears as I set my course toward the water's edge. I was determined to walk into the lake's cold darkness and find there the consolation that I could not find within myself. At the bottom of the hill, the street ended and the lakeside park began. I walked across the wet grass and climbed the last rise before the final descent to the water's edge. As I crested the rise, I discovered a line of dark objects between me and the shore, a barricade. I was going to have to cross to get to the water. I didn't remember this barricade being there before, and it was so dark, I couldn't tell what I was seeing. But as I edged closer, I discovered it was a line of human beings, hunched over some strange-looking, spindly equipment, telescopes. It was the Seattle Astronomy Club. There they were, with their homemade Heathkit telescopes and their top-of-the-line sharper image telescopes, dressed in their Gore-Tex backcountry gear and tennis shoes. A whole club of amateur scientists up and alert in the middle of the night because the sky was clear and the planets were near. To make my way to my death, I had to get past
and enthusiast in tennis shoes. He assumed I had come to look at the stars. "Here, let me show you," he said, and began to explain the star cluster his telescope was focused on. I had to brush the tears from my eyes to look through his telescope, but there it was, a red-orange spiral galaxy. Then he focused it on Jupiter, and I peered through to see that giant glowing planet. I could not bring myself to continue my journey. In a world where people get up in the middle of the night to look at the stars, I could not end my life. She concludes, I know there is grace because my life was saved by the Seattle Astronomy Club. Easter proclaims that we each have a part to play in how the story unfolds if we are willing to wake up. We listen for what is calling us, and like Mary, when we hear our name, we answer, rising anew to meet that life that will not stop calling our names. We are resurrected over and over again. Maybe by the Seattle Astronomy Club. Maybe, as I was the other day, by just a snippet of Handel's Messiah, or Handel's Alleluia chorus. We are resurrected maybe by an image, maybe by a picture. Maybe by a picture in the newspaper, even, as I was a few days ago, a picture in color of, and I do not know how to say this, it's the Hindu celebration of H-O-L-I. I want to say holy. But it's not only a festival of colors, but it's also marks the beginning of spring and celebrates the triumph of good over evil. We are resurrected daily by a swath of color, maybe, catching your eye as you walk down the sidewalk and realize you're looking at the first flowers of spring, those snowdrops and the crocuses. How amazing. Resurrection is intertwined with connection to life. Easter is a gift that we are offered every year, and I hope that we are open enough, free thinking enough, and firm enough in that free thinkingness to accept the gift. Closing words are those of Unitarian Universalist minister David Blanchard. Through resurrections of our own fashioning, we rise to hope, rise to love, rise to heal, rise to forgive, rise to courage, rise even to foolishness, rise to wisdom, rise even to die, but most essentially, rise to life. Not to die a hero, but to live as one. May we rise to life. Go in peace, greet your neighbors, drink coffee if you want to.